In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred here in Little Stevens Underground Garage with your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Today's interview is part two of my conversation with famed songwriter, producer, and music business entrepreneur, Richard Goddard. In part two, we find out more about the early days of Sire Records, including the importance of baked goods in cementing business relationships, Richard's return to producing and working with groups like Blondie, the Go-Go's, and others, as well as the founding and the development of the music and entertainment company, The Orchard. As I mentioned, one of the bands Richard worked with early on was Blondie. Let's hear some of their track, Ex-Offender, opening cut to their self-titled album, and then I'll be back with part two of our Richard Goddard Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, in Little Stevens' Underground Garage.
I saw you standing on the corner. You look so big and fine. I really wanted to go out with you. So when you smiled, I laid my heart on the line.
Picking up where we left off, Richard, you told us that Sire Records began around that time. I became aware of Sire, you know, more as the home to sort of punk and new wave stuff going on beginning in the mid to late 70s. But as you said, the label actually started in the 60s, around 66. What was the idea for the label at that time?
Well, the interesting thing was, our original idea was, because you have to do things realistically if you're independent, and you have to keep your budgets fairly small. So we started off, Seymour had a connection with his name is Danny Gittleman. He was a one-stop rec job distributor. First of all, we started as a production company, and we made recordings for Date Epic. We had a production deal. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we were doing sort of R&B. I was doing a remake of something with Dee Clark. There's a great song. I always loved the Howlin' Wolf song, Going Down Slow. I did a version with a guy named Guitar Crusher. And then, female version of, I'll think of Maddie Moultrie. I'll think of it in a minute. So we did R&B. We did R&B songs for them. Nothing much happened with it. We went into business with Danny, who directed us to London Records because he had an association there. And because as a rep jobber, meaning one-stop distributor, it was important to record companies. And he was able to get us together and get a deal for Sire Records with London Records. Now, at the time, we started putting out folk-type records, a couple of early Sire records, David Santos, Rosalie Sorrells, Gene Ritchie. These are recordings by folk artists that you could do inexpensively, and there was a market for it.
Yeah.
But nothing really buzzed up with them. Nothing happened. And then Seymour and I started thinking about what the next step could be. And right at that time, the marketplace was changing the way it changed with digital, but in a different way. Radio was changing. AM radio was dominant still, but that was singles. When it came to albums, most people did not make albums at the time. The B Beatles, when they got successful albums, the Stones, when they got successful albums, but you needed that single first.
Yeah.
When the attention for radio changed a bit and there was focus on the FM signal, FM was in stereo. Record companies, if they saw the change and wanted to go for it, needed albums. Seymour and I started traveling in Europe. We'd go over, and this is really true, because years before, when FGG was starting to be hot producers, what I used to do was we'd go to the Turf restaurant, which was in 1650 Broadway, and there was a cheesecake there called the Turf Cheesecake. I found out where you could get the cheesecakes. It was a big shop in uptown east side Manhattan. And I would take the cheesecake, I'd put the acetate in the box, send it to WKBW, which is a 50,000-watt station in Buffalo, New York. You could go to a certain place in Long Island, an area, you know, just outside of New York City, and you could pick up the 50,000-watt station. They would take the cheesecake as a gift, and they would play our acetate so we could hear what it would sound like on the radio before doing the final mastering. So that's backstory. Seymour and I start going over, and we figured we need an introduction to people. We bring 10 cheesecakes, go to the export division of the major record companies. Now, remember, the major record companies who had counterparts in the United States were making recordings, albums in the UK, but their American counterparts didn't want to put them out unless they were hits.
Yeah.
What we were interested in was the good music that could be played on these new FM outlets that weren't hits. You know, not too complicated. Give us something good.
Yeah.
And we would hear, like, to introduce myself, give you a cheesecake. Next time we'd come back, I would say, paint another cheesecake? Sure. What do you got for us? And these export divisions of EMI, Decca, Pi, other people that we'd meet would want to have their records released in the United States. So Sire picked up Climax Blues Band. At the time, they were Climax Chicago Blues Band. Maybe they were eventually able to tour here. Renaissance. I'm trying to Mick Farren. I'm trying to think of lots of the other ones. And we took trips around the rest of the world to try to find content that nobody wanted to release in the United States, but would be good for here. And we started picking up albums. That led us one time to Holland. And in the Netherlands, we met someone at a conference who had a group that was an instrumental group that no one seemed to actually want outside the Netherlands. And we said, oh, we'll take it. We went in partnership with somebody else who put up the money that we didn't have to pay him to get the group. We put it out. It doesn't sell much, but there's a need for a second album. We had a partner in another label called Blue Horizon, because that was another collection of people we met. I'll get to that in a minute. And he, Mike Vernon, became the producer of this group, Focus.
Oh.
He goes and makes this album. We put it out, and it's, it changes. But we picked up Focus. We continued with it, put it out, and it had Hocus Pocus, which was a massive hit globally. Not sure if it got to number one in the United States. You could check that. But that was the first huge album that Sire ever had. And this is pre-punk, okay?
Right.
So Sire was an active label putting out albums catering to the FM community well before the punk period, had successful records with Renaissance, Climax Blues Band, and Focus. And we continued putting out albums through various distribution partnerships after leaving London, Polydor, and then Focus came out through Famous Music. Paramount Pictures had a record company. So during the course of traveling, we also met these two brothers that had a little blues-oriented record label. And we had been able to accumulate some money by then, having small album hits. So we bought into their company as partners. It was called Blue Horizon Records.
Right.
Blue Horizon had, it was a British blues label where they took older blues, traditional blues singers, and made modern recordings with them when they would come to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a blues revival in the UK, and they also recorded contemporary artists. One of them was the original Fleetwood Mac, Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, Peter, much different than the eventual Fleetwood Mac, but also they had a group called Dan Webb's Chicken Shack. And in Chicken Shack was John McVie and Christine McVie. Christine became Christine Perfect. The two of them together with Mick Fleetwood formed the legendary Fleetwood Mac later on.
Yeah.
But the earliest incarnations of them were the Blues Fleetwood Mac, the Blues Chicken Shack, and Christine Perfect had some singles that were successful in the UK as well.
About this period of time, Sire is putting out these different artists, as you've described. Well, were you doing any producing with any of these artists, or they had already done records and you guys were, you know, were...
No, most of them had already done records. However, we built a relationship with the Climax, and I went over and I recorded a couple of albums with Climax.
Yeah.
So I did a few of the albums, and then I did some recording with Renaissance. We recorded a live Renaissance album in Carnegie Hall. You know, I mean, we did stuff like that. And I had been producing some of the things, but I got away from producing.
Yeah.
And a lot of traveling. And as we were doing this, you see the business shifting. Because in America, it shifted dramatically. And you would be familiar with this coming from radio. AM was vital, and it was our music was heard and played. But all of a sudden, FM, stereo, speakers changed. Technology started to change everything. Recordings were going from mono to everybody was recording in stereo.
Yeah.
And you got to remember, the genius of Phil Spector was finding how to combine all those noises in a way that it made that magic moment. Once you hear it all separated, you better get it in tune. You know,
yeah.
A lot of the great music that we find doesn't necessarily, tuning is relative. You know, perfect tuning doesn't make things perfect. But when you take a noise and you take all the elements, some that are in tune, some that are off the beat, some, but when you put it together, early Rolling Stones, early R&B, you know, it's what you do with it when you put it together that makes that magic moment. Now those magic moments were changing. Now we were creating sound and soundscapes and sound illusions, you know, things you could reach for in a different way. And FM was essential to that. And it eventually led to the growth of a different sort of artistic expression for artists.
Yeah.
You know, and skill sets that we didn't realize we had as young people. And you would hear these things in reality, you know. So those changes occurred with the shift to FM. And then, of course, along comes the refinement, the discovery of artists that have a different sort of artistry to say, not just Bob Dylan, who's still part of the mono period, but crossed over, of course. But you know, the California recording, the refinement of the recording studios, and you have a development together with hippie culture, changing culture in America, segregation, changing the Vietnam War. You have all these expressions of culture coming out and translated in a musical form that doesn't have to be confined specifically to 3 minutes. And that's the history of the album. It gives you a story, you know. Unfortunately, we lost that later on when it became an economic sense to sell people volume.
right.
attached to one moment in time. And that's where it got lost. But, you know, it was a wonderful period. It was a wonderful period. And you saw a growth of the songwriter again, who could express themselves with a vision over a period of time. And all that had to do with FM radio. That was a trigger.
That was a trigger. And so the latter part of the 60s, you're involved with Seymour Stein, and you guys together start Sire Records, and you're doing this world, a lot of traveling to find different groups to put out, not producing quite as much as you had been before. But then you leave Sire Records somewhere in the mid-70s, or when do you stop being associated?
Yeah, actually, we were together from 1966, 67 to about 70, mid-late 76. The important thing, Sire, is what I learned is the world outside the United States as well.
Yeah.
So I had these relationships. I understood that music is global. It's not confined to this space that we're in, this military space we're in.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because as much as I really love all the real building world, but outside of Burt Burns, as you mentioned, him traveling overseas, my understanding is that none of the Goffin King or Jeff Barry, Ellie Greenwich, these people really, you know, they were aware when the British invasion came, but they were, you know, in a sense, sort of parochial in their sort of insular world there, their songwriting world, when everybody seems to have a connection. Yeah. You mentioned Wes Farrell being instrumental with you guys when you were first starting out. And I know, like Wes Farrell, he wrote songs with Burt Burns, and there's all these connections going on. But I think that is really poignant for you to be able to have had this moment where you can go abroad and see how the rest of the world, how everything is feeding into each other, and what that is for important.
Yeah, no, it was very important. And I would say that I'm sure they traveled, but outside of, say, Carole King, who crossed into a complete other world as an artist,
yeah.
I mean, Ellie Greenwich was an artist as well, and, you know, there were other things that came out of it, but their world was insular to songwriting and more United States. But Sire, the early days of Sire opened up me to was the experience of the rest of the world, and understanding that the global sense, and that comes into play later again. But yeah, so I left Sire, sold my interest in Seymour, went on, wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then I met some other people that were, I had been involved with them, with a young guy at Sire that I found and brought into Sire, Craig Leon. And he eventually became a really, really great producer. And another fellow, Marty Thau. Marty was a promotion-oriented person that I knew from some other areas, and he kept telling me, you got to come down, something's going on. Where I met Marty was, now I got it, he found and managed David Johansen and the New York Dolls.
Oh, okay, right.
Right?
Yeah.
So the Dolls were the beginning of a glam downtown scene. So once you're downtown in lower Manhattan, it's a bit of a glam scene, and there's raves going on. Once you look at that, something else happens. There's clubs, the Mud Club, a lot of other things happening musically. And then he tells me, Richard, you've got to come down and see what's happening. Listen, you'd love this down at this place on the Bowery, CBGB's. So I go down with him, and together we decide, well, you can do this, maybe I'll produce some things, and let's see what we can put together out of here. And my idea, because I was coming from a production standpoint, was, well, I hear all these bands, maybe they all have one song. If I could put together a CBGB's package, a song or two by each of these artists, and then place them individually as a production company with labels, wouldn't that be amazing? So I start contacting them, going to CB's, looking at it, and I spoke to Talking Heads. I spoke to we spoke to Richard Hell. So Robert Gordon was at the time in a band called Tough Darts.
Yeah.
There were others. Patti Smith would play down there all the time. So we set up Instant Records. Instant became my place where I started signing people.
Uh-huh.
And we signed Richard Hell and the Voidoids, Robert Gordon, but not with the Tough Darts. We signed him as he wanted to be a rockabilly artist.
Yeah.
And while I'm down at CBGB's one time, Hilly Crystal, the man who owned the place, legendary person in that part of the music, said, oh, there's someone who wants to meet you. She'd like to be on your album. Uh-huh. And he introduced me to Debbie. And I had seen them, and they weren't necessarily that great, but there was something. So I said, okay, but, you know, I got to hear you play. Let's set up rehearsal. And I remember going to rehearsal, and I tell this all the time, that I was just grinning from ear to ear. I couldn't stop smiling. It's about the songs. They just played with such fire and enthusiasm, not perfection, but it didn't matter to me because the songs and her ability to just translate a personality was so great that I said, sure, and we signed them as well.
Right, and we're talking about Blondie here because you haven't actually mentioned
we're talking about Blondie.
Yeah.
First, we're talking about Blondie. So I started making records. We found a studio. I found a studio called Plaza Sound. It was on the, I think, fifth or sixth or seventh floor of Radio City Music Hall. The room was ideal for me because it was massive. It had been built when NBC wanted to get Toscanini to come over and conduct the NBC orchestra. They actually built this room for him, his symphonies. Well, we're making punk records in this massive room. And massive because I love the drum sound.
Yeah.
Studios were amazing for drum sound. The beat is everything. So we went in there and made a single with Blondie, and the first single was called Sex Offender. We were able to place it with an independent record company called Private Stock. The problem was they were sure radio would never play anything with the word sex in it.
Yeah.
So we changed it to X Offender. And I had written a narration in the front because it's like my boyfriend's back. So I wrote this narration, which the band hated, and they cut off the record. But it is on some versions. And it came out and really didn't do very much, but he had an affiliated label in the UK, kind of stock, and it started getting attention because punk was getting attention. And that led us to making an album deal with Private Stock for Blondie. And that's the first Blondie album comes out. So at the same time, I'm all locked into Private Stock. It seems great. I did a Robert Gordon album, because then I started saying, well, you got to do albums. So I did a Robert Gordon rockabilly album.
And was this with Link Ray?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, at first, the guitar player was Johnny Thunders. I wish I could find those tapes. We did a session with Johnny and Mark Bell playing the drums from the Ramones. And so we needed a guitar player to make it work. And I'm trying to think of the context of it. I think Bob Feldman had worked with Link on the album that he does with the Native American, I forgot the name of it. It was on Polydor.
Yeah,
and the cover
like
is Link.
Profile on the cover. I can't think of the name of the album.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? So
yeah.
He introduced me to Link. I talked to Link, who obviously was a rockabilly cat, you know, beside being a massive influencer to all guitar players in life. And if he doesn't get in the rock, you know, it's so fucking stupid, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If he doesn't get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's not a Hall of Fame, okay?
Right.
I mean, and I know my good friend Steve Van Zandt feels exactly the same, but it's kind of ridiculous that you call something a Hall of Fame, but you don't put famous people in it, you know? You just put popular people. Anyway, where were we? Oh.
That Link Ray album is just tied on Polydor, is just self-titled, it's just Link Ray. And so Bob had worked with Link Ray on that?
Yeah, I think Bob did. Yeah, oh. And that's how I met Link. And Link, so I put Link and Robert together, and we made this great rockabilly album, and there are a couple of really great songs on it. But they're all covers. You know, I mean, nothing wrong with that. It's the one that got the most attention was My Gal Is Red Hot. Your Gal Ain't Doobie Squat. My Gal Is Red Hot. I think it was Billy C. Riley was the original recording. But there's some great Link guitar playing, and Robert's voice is phenomenal. But it fit an image, and we started to grow it, you know, and did a second album for Private Stock. And then it didn't work out. We moved him to RCA and did another one. And Link left and wanted to be a solo artist. And then I found Chris Spedding, another great guitar player. I found him in UK on one of my trips. And he said he'd be happy to come to America and be part of this. That expanded. And going back to CBGB's, the other person who had just put a band together was amazing, Richard Hell. Yeah. He put this really eclectic band together. Originally, Mark Bell, who became Marky Ramone, was the drummer. Richard played bass. Ivan was the guitar player, and Bob Quine. And they were just really weird and musically and amazing. And I just thought Blank Generation would be the anthem for the generation. Right. It didn't turn out that way, but I was still talking to Seymour, and I had access to, he had just moved to Warner's, Sire, so I licensed the Richard Hell album to Sire. So that's why you see it on Sire, because Sire had gotten into punk with the Ramones. Mm-hmm. Craig Leon brought the Ramones there. And Seymour really pursued the Talking Heads, who turned out to be just phenomenal. You know, went far beyond the punk. The Ramones stayed punk. Richard pretty much was poetic punk, and the Talking Heads far beyond it. Mm-hmm. And that led Seymour and Sire. That was the triggers that led to the monstrous success, you know, that Sire continued to have. And I went on and continued to produce Coots. And at that point, I can't even remember all the artists. I think I started letting record companies who wanted to use me as a producer just hire me. So I would just work as an independent producer. It wasn't as much as going out finding individual things.
Well, one artist I wanted to ask you about was you worked with the Go-Go's on their first two albums. And you know, 20 years before that, you'd been, you know, gotten your start working with a lot of these girl groups. So here is 20 years later at that point. Was there any difference working between gals in the, you know, early 60s versus the early 80s? I mean, the Go-Go's obviously played their own instruments. Were they more savvy about the recording process?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of difference. I mean, there's a lot of difference. Well, first of all, the Go-Go's it was the early 80s, right? I had continued doing productions. One of the other great ones I did was Joan Armatrading, Me, Myself, I, and also, God, why can't I remember, Nighttime, Dr. Feelgood. And these are people that the companies hired me, and I did a great recording with Dr. Feelgood called Milk and Alcohol. And, of course, Joan Armatrading. And so that led me into the 80s. And in the 80s, Miles Copeland, who I spoke to the other day, asked me about it, told me about this girl group. And he had just started IRS Records and wanted me to produce it. But I wasn't that interested. I wanted to do things what I considered more meaningful, not girl groups. You know, just I wanted to widen my sphere. The manager, Ginger Centenary, called me and said, you got to come and see them play. And they were playing at NYU at Loeb Civic Center. And again, it was like the Blondie experience. Just the songs were just overwhelmingly great. And they used to do a version of the Cool Jerk, which was kind of cool. And they had already achieved a degree of success. A degree with an EP or album they put out on Stiff Records in the UK. And it sold some here because remember, punk and alternative was now becoming a familiar mode of music to people. So to answer your question now, yes, vastly different. Girls, when I was of that age, girls in 1963 until, let's say, Leader of the Pack came along. Could have just been girls from the 50s, just straight innocence, right? The shift was coming. The Shangri-Las were just different than the Angels. You know, they were in the newer generation that was experiencing these culture of changes. As you go from the Angels, and then 20 years later, the Go-Go's were already born into this completely different cultural world, different musical world. They really felt not like a woman has to be a homemaker. You know, you can play instruments. You can be your own person, you know. And they wrote great songs. They were, like, very comfortable with relaxed people in terms of understanding themselves, and they were good musicians because they could translate it. People would listen to it and probably say, oh yeah, somebody could play this better or that better. But what makes a great band is the noise they make together. It's the combination of the people. You could listen to the Rolling Stones and love them and then see it sell tens of millions. And then Keith puts out an album, or Mick puts out an album separately with different people, and nobody cares, really, because it's not that noise. It's not that joining of feeling. These people, the Go-Go's, just had that. It just came together. And all I had to do was recognize that and give them the direction to help them be the best they could be at what it was they were capable of. So, yes, it was a very different experience. Recording the Angels, we wrote the songs, did the music, told them to sing. With the Go-Go's, you work on the music together with them, add what's necessary to make it that little step better or more acceptable, and allow them to be themselves while still maintaining some basis for feel, timing, organization, give them the direction they need to do it. And they very much did it themselves with my help. You know, I don't want to minimize my contribution, which I think was major, but without their ability to do it, I couldn't have convinced anybody. It's a great experience.
Well, I want to ask you here about from that later flowering period of your producing career from the late 70s, mid 80s, was there one artist, one group you worked with that, you know, time hasn't been good to, that you think, like, man, people should really check out, I worked with so-and-so, they weren't really well known, but this was a great artist that people may have forgotten about?
It was a guy, but it was a 90s. His name is Jeffrey Gaines. He was on EMI Christmas. That's who I would say. There are numbers. I mean, there's a record that I absolutely love by a group called the Bongos.
Oh, yeah. I remember the Bongos, yeah.
It's called Numbers with Wings.
And what did that come out on?
You got me.
I was working college radio at the time, and I remember, you know, the album when it came out and playing it. Seems like it has kind of a...
Richard Barone, he played this guitar with a device on it that made a special sound. But look for Numbers with Wings, not as an album, as a song. It's really great. Jeffrey Gaines, he's another artist, I would say.
Okay, that's right.
Just make it to the level that he should have.
Now, was his release a self-titled album?
Might have. I'm trying to remember. I don't have my computer in front of me. Find it on Spotify. You'll find it. He had several albums, but the first one in particular.
Yeah, 1992 on Chrysalis, as you mentioned, Chrysalis.
Yeah, but that, I think you'll find, is great. And then sort of go on and continue to do productions, various productions. It's hard to follow the chronology of it. But I guess, so that was 92. As we get up to 95 or so, I meet someone who's managing a group, and I get back into, okay, let's put this together, try to get them a production deal. And then we become friends and we form a small label to put out stuff for ourselves called Soul Free, S-O-L 3 Records, Third Planet from the Sun to Earth.
I got you.
And we start putting out records. I produce some again, and there's an artist we pick up who just left Phonogram that had a hit. The artist was called Consolidated, and we start getting a little attention. Distribution's hard to come by, and here we go again. Just like AM to FM, I'm sitting there, and nobody can't get our records on the radio, nothing. We have interns working for us, and these are people who want experience. And it's the early days of computers. We bought a couple and said, go online, go on this thing called Netscape, whatever, and see if anybody's talking about anything. And sure enough, there was heavy metal talking forums. And we would write in, have these interns write in and say, have you heard Consolidated? Are you familiar? Right? And we saw people would write us back. And people were communicating this way.
Yeah.
So next thing you see is that there are record stores on the internet. I said, that's ridiculous. How could there be record stores? Music Boulevard and one called CD Now. Okay?
Yeah.
Just it's simple as that. So using whatever knowledge I had from the past about the music business, we contacted somehow CD Now and Music Boulevard and said, well, we have these records and we want them in your stores. Well, you can't get that. Why can't you get it? Because we're not really stores. We're a virtual front, they explained to me. What's a virtual front? They put up the visual, the back end. I said, where's your back end supplied by? They tell me it's a place in California called Valley. Valley Media was the largest one-stop distributor in America. They had over 250,000 titles from all the major labels they represented, and they would supply them to stores. Two of the stores they supplied them to were these virtual fronts,
right,
which sounded like a good idea. Go out to Valley. Scott Cohen is the man who I started this with.
Mm-hmm.
We get on a plane, fly to San Francisco, rent a car, drive to Sacramento, and go to Valley, sit down, and say, I see you don't have any independent music in these stores. We want to bring you every independent artist in the world. Right? Now, just think about this. This is 1996. There's barely any broadband. There's barely anything. We don't have one artist signed at the time. So I'm sitting with these executives, right? And they said, well, Richard, could you tell us about just what I'm talking to you about, the entire story? So you wrote these songs. Could you tell us about Blondie? Could you tell? So if you're going to talk about Full Circle, my God, the fact that I was involved with my boyfriend's back got you to pay attention to me while I'm talking to you about going into another business? Sure, I'll tell you these stories. Tell them all the stories. They say, my God, Richard, you're one of us. I think we're going to do this deal with you. Right there, the orchard is born. Okay?
Yeah.
And that was it. If it wasn't for all this stuff that came before, orchard wouldn't have been born. So the orchard's born, and it's born out of real music record business, historic, one step to the next step, to the next step, to the next step. It's not invented in a vacuum. I got to that place, but we did recognize, just like when AM went to FM, you recognize that physical, as great as it still is, was going somewhere else. And it wasn't going purely to the digital that started when we started manufacturing CDs, which we were told would never end.
Yeah.
You know, that changed the music business. That was a digital shift. But that was only a step toward this. So we go back to New York. We're now the exclusive providers to Valley of Independent Music on their online stores. So now we start acquiring artists, telling them, taking ads, saying you can get into these stores, but you don't even get into it through us. But along with that, you have to grant us the right to distribute and sell your music digitally. Okay, everybody says, yeah, because they don't know what digital is. So we have all these digital rights, plus we're building a warehouse in the basement and supplying CDs back to Valley, who are shipping a mail order through these online stores to people who build them, who order them. And it's all fine. And then all of a sudden, shift from everything to broadband. Broadband opens up the world, and everybody's on now. The shift goes to digital. We're still thinking, because of Napster, people are stealing music I'm not going to put my music that way. People are stealing it. Along comes a company, Apple, that goes to the who's got billions of dollars in the bank and goes to record companies and says, we're starting a store. It's a digital store. We're going to pay you the same thing you get now, $1 for a single, essentially $10 for an album. Can we distribute these? Apple goes into business. iTunes begins. The iPod happens. And there's the Orchard with 150,000 titles. Of course, they weren't titles that everybody wanted yet, but there are a lot of titles. The Orchard is now in the digital business. Scott Cohen and I, start traveling around the world, going to conferences, talking about this is the future. This is where it's at. This is what it's going to be. Again, go back to, I know about the world because I learned it in my early days as Sire. I continued on it all the way through the 80s and 90s. So I could go to anywhere in the world and where I produced records and new people and go to conferences, talk about music, and then relate it to the future, which is what we did. And before we knew it, we had people working for us in almost every major country. We had a few people in the UK, a person in France, aggregating content, a person in Scandinavia, a person in Germany. Some of these people are still with the Orchard 20-some-odd years later, South America. And then we go on and we take an investment that allows us to expand more and more. And we grow the company to the point where we become the largest distributor of, quote, digital music in the world. And now we're literally the largest distributor of music in the world. The investors sold their shares to Sony. So Sony now is the owner of the Orchard.
Right.
But because of their great leadership and guidance by people like Rob Stringer, he's allowed the head of music, actually, he's guides the Orchard and allows it to grow in the way it continued to grow in the way it was always growing. So we've become like a central point for the development of independent music on a global sense. We're involved with BTS, for example. My vision for the Orchard always was that music from anywhere could reach people everywhere and break down barriers between people. It's more than just, wow, the song is cool. It's, are you German and can you really sing in Korean? I mean, think about that. You go, whatever one thinks of BTS or their music, the barriers that they break down and create value, you know, for the world goes beyond just the success and the money they earn. It's a global presence. The fact that the Latin artists we have now, I understand Spanish is a pretty global language, but people who don't speak Spanish are singing along with them in Spanish. We distribute music from Eastern Europe and Russian and Turkish, and you cross all these barriers. It does what music does. It's a cultural experience that breaks down barriers, is meaningful, and creates a better world and a better future. And at the same time, brings immediate pleasure and enjoyment to those that experience it. So I don't know if that story of the Orchard was beneficial to you, but...
It is. And what I want to ask you here about is, so over the course of your career, you've been through these different shifts. And here we're just mentioning the Orchard and the shift to digital and just people not buying a physical product, but, you know, buying the recording and playing it through whatever device they want. And you mentioned, you know, Apple coming in and the creating iTunes. And then sometime last year they announced ending iTunes and trying to get everybody just to subscribe, you know, subscription.
Yeah, iTunes was, I got you. That was to the point that iTunes was a download site. I mean, that was a miracle when people could download music and own it. They didn't have to physically own it. But we knew, Scott and I, when we started the Orchard, that the day would come when we used to talk about this great jukebox in the sky.
Yeah.
You know, Apple Music, in a sense, became that, not iTunes, because it became this place where music lives, and if you subscribe to it, as well, of course, as Spotify, which is the largest, but you find Amazon has that, Tidal came along, Deezer, but it's not a jukebox in the sky. The sky really isn't in the sky, it's in the cloud, which is a massive storage spaces on Earth, but it exists virtually.
Right, so my question
we always knew.
What do you feel, or how do you feel about, instead of someone buying a track, that the industry is moving towards people subscribing to their particular services, like a subscription?
Well, you're getting the music. You're paying for it. You're getting the music. It's a step at a time. You have to remember, I don't want to go back to the record business. It was basically furniture stores.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no record business. It was somebody invented the phonograph from Edison, and it was stuck in a piece of furniture. The only way you'd get it was buying the furniture. The furniture store went into becoming a record label because they made discs to play in their furniture. So we progressed from a furniture store buying furniture into buying discs, into buying albums, into buying something else, But we're living in a world today which is mostly virtual anyway. Look, you and I are talking. We're locked down at home, but we can visually see things. We can have conferences. We can still do business. So we're living in a virtual world. We're living in a world where basically ownership of possessions and things, I believe, will diminish. Will it go away? I don't know. I won't be around to see that. But do you have to physically own something in order to enjoy it? I don't think so. It's nice if somebody wants it. If you want to have vinyl and you think it's better, as long as someone's willing to manufacture it, it's great. But the idea of going to a store specifically to get it these days, unfortunately, it's a wonderful experience, but unfortunately, it's diminishing. And this is going to diminish it even further, what we're going through now.
Yeah.
So I'm fine with the world going ahead and the future being what it is. We're never going back. So whether I like it or not doesn't matter. Fact is, it's never going back, you know?
Yeah, in fact, that's a very good answer. Now, we're in the midst, you mentioned again, in the midst of this coronavirus reality and shutdowns. Once this is over, do you have any artists that you look forward to producing? Are you still working with artists right now or managing anyone?
Oh, yeah, still working with artists. No, we're still working with artists now. We do it virtually. We can mix things. We can communicate with them online. And the Orchard is still, the Orchard's not, that's the thing about the Orchard, which is what's amazing about it, is it's not locked down. We're locked out of the office because we were told to close and lock down, remain at home. But we communicate virtually, we operate remotely, even our physical releases for Record Store Day are coming out. We deal with the artist. Nothing has changed. We're able to operate remotely. The only thing that's changed is personal contact. I personally believe that personal contact and personal communication, face-to-face, voice-to-voice, is important in the human experience. But as humanity gets less human, which is coming with AI, with virtual reality, you know, as we become less human, generation by generation, as we go into the future, we're going to look back at these moments of touching as miracles of experience. But is the world going to be like this? Absolutely not. The world's gone so far away from intimacy. Intimacy changes. It's just amazing. So if you think, I started writing a song on the piano, making recordings monaural, and that was a miracle. That was state-of-the-art. 4-track was state-of-the-art. 12-track was state-of-the-art. 24-track was state-of-the-art. 16-track, 64-track was state-of-the-art. Recording digitally on tape machines, you had to use plastic gloves to touch, was state-of-the-art. All sorts of digital recordings are state-of-the-art. Really? You think it ends here? Absolutely not. The future is like, it's like amazing. The moment we were living in that we look back to as being, oh, nostalgia, it wasn't nostalgia. It was the future as we were living in it, you know? And that's what we have to accept. For people who say, oh, recordings were better when it was made on tape. Really? It might have been. But that was state of the art in that moment. And that's the important thing to remember, is that state of the art becomes a nostalgia as soon as something else comes in. As the world changes, there's nothing we can do about it. The only thing that will ever bring it back is what's happening right now. If we do not have access to grow, we're going to look back at some of these things as, gee, I'm missing them. But as long as we have access to grow and change, it just becomes nostalgia. And I'd rather, as much as I love the past, and I loved living through it all, as much as I love it, I can't escape it because of who I am. I would rather be part of today and be part of every future moment as it grows and grows and grows. I don't really like the commercialism as much as I like the growth and contribution to art. But that's life, you know, and I'd rather just grow with it all.
Well, so much upheaval, change of the course of the music business, and you mentioned about going forward, but still isn't the one essential thing and you know, rock, pop music. I mean, the song still has to be there, right? I mean, that's the building block from for the artist.
Well, the problem, the issue today is that and the Orchard is partly responsible for this. The world is opened up so that everybody can easily do it, right?
Yeah.
So you have a lot of music, some that's not that good, it's relative, but a lot that's good because everybody now can do it. How to find the greatness in it is where the problem comes, because you have so much, you have such a glut of it, it's harder to identify the greatness and harder for the greatness to get through. But at the same time, if you're great, that's what makes it work, and it's the song. Always, always the song. It's the song that that leads to everything. Then the artist that delivers it. But without great songs, you can't have great music, you know, and you can't have great recordings. But I'll agree with you that it's always the song. Song, then the artist's ability to deliver the song, and then the collective ability to create the entity that's that piece of individual music, and then the ability to market and promote it. But the last thing I'll say is, to me, and I would say to anybody making music, the making of it and the feeling that you get from doing it at that moment is your success. Whether anybody buys it, listens to it, or does anything with it, doesn't really matter. That's the gravy that comes after it. The doing of it is the success. The doing of it is what matters. So anybody out there listening, if you want to create music, you create it. Enjoy it when you do it, and then look to do more with it. But never look at it as a failure if it doesn't succeed in the worldly version of how people judge a success. Judgment isn't it. Your judgment is what matters. If you do it, and you do it great, and the songs are great, and you're singing, and the recording is great, then you've already succeeded. And if the world accepts it, and as you grow, then that's what makes it an additional success. So that's it. That's how I've always looked at it.
We'll wrap up here then, but let me ask you this. Do you still do any songwriting?
A little. Not much. I try, unfortunately. And again, I'll say to anybody who writes songs out there, to wrap it up, always write songs. It's the most lucrative part of the entire business. And if you write a great song, like, as silly as it sounds, my boyfriend's back and I want candy. 56 years later, they earn more today than they did when they were hits. Songs that touch people and become part of the culture last far beyond their short-term value. So, yes, I don't, but I'm an idiot for not. And if I was smart, I'd sit down at the piano and I'd write songs now while I'm locked in at home instead of talking to you.
Well, I really, really appreciate you taking so much time for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations podcast. It's been such an honor to pick your brain.
Sure, man. Thank you very much. And anything for my friend Stephen, you know, I love the Underground Garage and I love Stephen's aunt. And he keeps the spirit of music alive. So that's good enough for me.
We'll go out with the Ravenettes off of Pretty in Black, because you produced that album, that track, Love in a Trash Can. Is that cool with you?
Oh, I love Love. That's one of the great guitar solos of all time, as far as I'm concerned.
Trash Can. That's the Ravenettes off their album Pretty in Black here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and that track was produced by Richard Goddard. And thanks again to Richard for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations podcast. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing both parts 1 and 2. Remember to follow and subscribe, rate and review, and join us again next week for your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.